9th of January 2000. We've got some guests scheduled to call in. Wiley Drake from Washington, D.C., talking about Buena Park and the fight to let homeless people sleep in churches, if that's what the church wants. And hopefully some local guests talking about hot local issues. Dolphin Lee, the upcoming City Council's sleeping ban debate, which they won't hold, but maybe will be held in the audience. Stay tuned. Starting a little late on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides here on 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We've got 2.5 hours ahead of us, a little less actually, and my apologies to those who tuned in sharply at 11. We had trouble breaking into the studio, but after we eliminated one wall and got to the second one, we did fine. Actually, it's just one of those scratchy locks, having trouble with the locks getting in. My apologies, folks. Interesting stuff on the internet today around Attica. That's the prison that where there was a rebellion back in 1971 and a recent legal settlement. We're going to look into that a bit later. And coming up tomorrow are two meetings of interest to folks concerned with civil rights for people on the streets. One of them is the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, or the Review Board, as they like to style themselves. That's at 5:30 at City Hall. And then starting at the same time is the Homeless Issues Task Force. That's the group that made a brave stand back on December 6th and demanded that City Council pass a resolution ending the sleeping and camping bans until such time as there was safe places for people to sleep, given the winter crisis, the fact that we have hundreds and hundreds of homeless people outside without legal or safe places to sleep and facing $54 tickets, beatings, unsolved assaults on homeless people, 18 deaths last year. The whole litany is quite familiar to those who have been following the show regularly, but for those of you who haven't, that's the sad story. City Council, under new mayor Keith Sugar, supposedly voted in as a super progressive back in November of 1998, has refused to do anything at all, at least not over the winter, at the time when it's most needed, and indeed at the time when the public is likely to be most receptive and sympathetic to it. There is a council meeting coming up on Tuesday, last Tuesday's special council meeting. Apparently, Sugar couldn't find it in his heart, or any of the other council members, I might say. Let's not blame him entirely, though he does have power of the agenda as mayor, and so does have to bear a significant burden here for making these choices. No one wanted to put any items about this unanimous Homeless Issues Task Force recommendation, which was suspend the sleeping and camping bans pending safe zone setups, on the agenda. And there was a massive call-in campaign that actually got Sugar and his political confreres into a huddle 2 days before the city council meeting on December 12th, that last city council meeting of the millennium in December, and their decision was to do nothing, thank you very much. And at city council, Sugar even let down a promise that he'd made on December 6th to the Homeless Issues Task Force, according to David Silva, and also that he seemed to me to have made on December 12th, which was if he wouldn't put the item on the agenda, the sleeping ban suspension, if he wouldn't put the item on the agenda as an emergency item, which he could always attempt to do as mayor, he might fail to be able to do that, but he could try. If he wouldn't do any of either of those two things, he would at least comment on the urgent pleas made from the public mic at the public comment section, which usually happens at 7 o'clock every other Tuesday at City Hall when the City Council usually meets. And on December 14th, he refused to do that. Or let's put it this way, he didn't do that. Neither did any other council member in terms of the sleeping ban. I think Fitzmaurice made a few vague comments about snacks at the armory and buses and so forth. But in terms of any real response to the basic human rights crisis, to the basic shelter social service crisis, it's been absolutely goose eggs, pretty much. We have less shelter this winter than we had the winter before because the capacity of the armory has dropped in the sense that it's been ruled 100 is their max. You can't go beyond 100, and last year they were cramming them in more than that, probably inappropriately and unwisely, but you know, in emergency circumstances, people do what emergencies will do. There is the hope that if the armory hits that 100 capacity this year, then a special kind of little, well, totally unused provision of the sleeping ban, which was passed last March, will go into effect, and that will allow the city attorney to dismiss citations later on that are given if you can show that the armory winter shelter was full when you got your ticket. The problem, of course, is this requires, again, all more legwork from the homeless. It requires you still get searched and hassled and moved on and put in fear on the night of the ticket. It still criminalizes you as a matter of basic human dignity and in terms of the city's shame in this matter. And it also leaves you in an unsafe situation because you have to be afraid of warrants going out. You have to be afraid of police finding you to give you that kind of hassle, so you hide, and perhaps you get found by trollbusters rather than being able to sleep in safe groups. So, all these considerations are being ignored by the City Council, and I'm urging everyone within the sound of my voice who's concerned about the rights and just this common decency toward people who have no choice, given our shelter crisis, thrice declared in the last decade, and still, actually, we have three pending shelter emergency resolutions which have never been nullified or declared at an end, 1990, 1995, and then the 1998 one, all of which, in essence, state there is no shelter for most homeless people in Santa Cruz. There is a shelter emergency. I encourage you to call 420-5020, that's the mayor's office and also the city council, 420-5020, easy number to remember, 420-5020, and leave a message that it's damn well high time that that issue is put on the agenda immediately. If he doesn't want to put it on as an emergency item for day after tomorrow on Tuesday, he can damn well do it in 2 weeks when the city council meets again. It actually meets again in 1 week. They're holding lots of meetings this month, but not a goddamn one for homeless people. Now, it is true that there is an issue on the agenda on Tuesday, which I encourage people to come to. That's the midterm report of the Homeless Issues Task Force, a report that was written actually a month ago and has been polished and worked with and so forth. And a lot of good recommendations have come out of the Homeless Issues Task Force, kind of in spite of themselves. They have recommended a living wage for homeless people. They've recommended homeless people be actually hired to do the kind of work that Don Lane is now getting the majority of the $10,000 appropriation of the Homeless Issues Task Force to do. Instead of homeless people, instead of him doing it, they recommend that this be, you know, this go to homeless people eventually. It should, of course, have gone there in the first place, but Lane was the secret backdoor appointee of Catherine Byers. Let's not say secret, let's say closed. There was no hiring process. There was no series of applicants. She just chose this former mayor, this crony of the so-called anti-progressive slate, the Quartararo, Steinau, Walden slate of last election. This was a man who was, you know, he was actually quite a liberal in his time, but since then he's become one of the political gang that hangs around City Hall. You know, they all scratch each other's backs, they get favors and jobs from each other, and he's one of that group. And he was chosen without any kind of input from homeless people or from the Homeless Issues Task Force members themselves. And he's getting the lion's share of the money, and of course there's been a lot of concern from some task force members and from me as well that the kind of role he plays is that of the Catherine Byers damper on the Homeless Issues Task Force, but they have refused to be damped, and that's what's the amazing thing. And they came out with this fine resolution, which they put forward, and is being blacked out. And indeed they got slapped across the face for it about a week ago at a Tuesday meeting with Mayor Keith Sugar, with Chris Crone not defending them, not standing up for them, not talking about the right to sleep, but playing little brother to big boy Keith Sugar. Just intolerable kind of behavior from people we elected as progressives who are supposed to be representing the poorest as well as their rich friends on the West Side and all the other people that they seem to have time for. I'm not suggesting necessarily that they are bad on all other issues. I'm glad that there was a preliminary attempt to get the Tideland set aside. I'm glad that Crone at least stands up against the shoulder tap law. And one hears occasional kind of complaints and concerns about the police department, but nothing in any sustained leadership fashion from these people. And what you hear from Sugar is the same old refrain, I will do nothing until I have the votes. I will say nothing until I have the secure majority behind the scenes. I will not help these people one iota on the sleeping ban civil rights issue. I don't want to hear about it until November elections. This is intolerable. This is not something we can tolerate from a mayor who was elected with a 64% progressive majority. I'm sorry. Keith Sugar, time to go back to the drawing board. And also, by the way, please return your phone calls from advocates who are trying to reach you. It's an appropriate public process to do so. If you want to phone this show, you can do so. Phone number here is, if I keep my voice, 427-3772. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. And this is the Bathrobes Piers Broadsides twice-weekly show. We do civil rights for the poor. And we try to do them hot and heavy, and also we try to let you in on the whole discussion. We're a little bit here and there this morning. So what I'm going to begin with is an older tape that I think you'll find hopefully not just instructive but also moving. Nutcracker Nick Whitehead, as I call him, is a reporter, a video journalist, an investigator, a poet, a playwright, and a longtime activist in the Santa Cruz community who you probably heard on other free radio shows. He did an interview with me about a month ago regarding a shooting in Salinas where he went to the city council meeting, the gathering there, and came back with quite a report. I played some of that report about a month ago, but wasn't able to play the whole report. I'm going to play it now, and I'm going to encourage folks to call in with their thoughts. This is about the shooting of Jose Hernandez, I believe his name is. I'm going to wait because the last name for the moment escapes me, but he mentions it. It's the first of two shootings in Salinas, killings by police, that have gotten the Latino community there into a state of genuine outrage and concern. Let's hear Nick.
It's December 9th, 1999, and with me is Nutcracker Nick Whitehead, as I call him, who's also anarchistic dog. You just can't keep in one place. But you also have a reputation as being a worker with SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, compiling
Indeed.
Archives on
Indeed.
Police misconduct.
Yeah. So I was down in Salinas the other day, and they were having a repeat demonstration regarding the shooting of Joe Hernandez, 32 or 38 shots fired in the vicinity of a peace promotional backyard where they deal with youth gang violence. And how odd the police would walk in there and shoot the husband of one of the main women in that cause.
Now, this is a fellow who, as I remember from reading the Salinas Californian and the Monterey Peninsula Herald, not much covered at all in the Santa Cruz papers.
No, not even in the local paper, the Salinas Californian. People there were remarking that a month had transpired before it made front page news. But it did, because they knew these demonstrators were going to show up at city council meeting.
This, of course, was the killing of a man, a Latino man who came over from Seaside to visit his sister in Salinas, and they had some disputes. She just wanted him to leave the house. She wasn't really concerned about her safety. By my understanding of conversations about two or three weeks ago, not directly with the family, but with those who had talked to the family, and of course some newspaper accounts, and he had a dull knife with him, is what I was told, and the police came. Essentially, they sent the SWAT team.
Yeah, this is the strangest thing, Robert, that two times that day, his stepdaughter was apprehensive that he might injure himself. He was threatening to injure himself with a knife.
Not injure others.
No, he wasn't threatening to injure others. Mm-hmm. And she made two calls. In both those calls, it was a non-emergency. It was not 911. It was just the regular police number. Mm-hmm. She just wanted some attention given to her father. And the first time, they sent two officers round, and the officers concluded there was no immediate threat to anybody. Mm-hmm. They went away. She called later in the day, and that time, for no apparent reason, they called the SWAT team. Not the regular police, the SWAT team.
The SWAT team are people, sharpshooters with rifles and things of that sort?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're prepared to shoot much more readily than a regular line officer.
Mm-hmm. And again, describe for us what happened. As far as you know, I know you weren't there.
I don't know whether he lunged. The police say that he lunged at them. They didn't say he stabbed anyone. They said he made aggressive motions towards them.
Within, lunging distance, or was he further away?
I don't actually know that.
Right. And so I guess he was shot then, I understand, so many times in the face that his body had to be a closed casket funeral?
The one of the daughters, 15-year-old, was sobbing so much when she tried to give testimony to the city council. It was incredibly emotional. There were three kids testified, one about 19, one 15, and then a boy of about 14. And the saddest thing that caused her to break down was that when she went to see her father's body, they couldn't let her see it because they said there's not enough. This was horrible. There's not enough of his face left for you to recognize your father.
See, you're emotional about yourself.
Man, it's just got to end. You know, Mel Mason was there. Mel Mason of the... He's taken these 7 league steps since the shooting of Charles Vaughan Sr. He was there, and Bruce McPherson was there, the senator. And the demonstrators interrupted a special session of the city council with Senator McPherson, and they put him on the spot, and that was the right thing to do. And the whole community stood there. I'm talking about 60 people interrupted this meeting, and they all stood there. And they were very polite, but they demanded that Mr. McPherson get changes in the rules of police shooting, that they don't have to shoot at a person's torso, which is a standard procedure. Everybody was asking, why can't they shoot a man in the arm or the leg at close range? Why can't
they? Yeah. He's not armed with a weapon, not
yeah.
such as a gun.
Yeah.
I guess a dull knife, you know, I mean. Wow.
Again, this is kind of a community involvement show, so I do invite you to join in, because that's what really makes it worthwhile. And we're hoping that some council members will join in. We've invited Tim Fitzmaurice to call in. Tim is currently at he's gotten a lot of pressure from me and criticism for siding with Catherine Byers on a number of votes, keeping the restrictive sleeping ban in play. That's the Santa Cruz law that makes sleeping outside or under blankets or in vehicles after 11 o'clock at night a $54 fine. In a city where only 5% of the homeless population are sheltered 8 months of the year, and during the winter only 20%. I think we may almost have this Nick Whitehead interview ready to conclude. And
when you hear the kids, you know, and they're breaking down at the mic, it is overwhelming for everybody.
This was at the Salinas City Council meeting last Friday.
Yeah, yeah. Now, another person who played an instrumental role there, thank God for his heart, was Joe Grossman, whose candidacy I'm working on. And Joe...
running for congressional seat against Representative Fred Foran.
Joe did a really good thing. He did not use it for political advantage, but at one point he got real close to McPherson, and he said, Mr. McPherson, are you going to be committed to bringing about these changes where the police departments throughout the state are retrained in how to deal with people with mental aberrations on the street or in their homes? Would you really stand for retraining them all, every officer eventually, and with having intervention systems, including mental health or psychological professionals, along with the police? And after some prevarication, I will say that Bruce McPherson seemed sincerely committed to achieving that.
Prevarication or procrastination?
Well, I think a politician prevaricates in that they don't want to answer directly because their Republican constituents are going to take him up on that score. But the more he thought about it, the more he seemed to realize it must be done, as he heard from a couple of speakers. And then Joe pressed him even further and said, will you support getting funding? Because that's an important thing. Politicians very often will agree to propose legislation, but then they don't follow up with the funding. And McPherson eventually said, yes, I will. So we had that. We didn't record it, unfortunately.
Well, it's if he spoke at the city council mic, there's probably a tape and evidence made by the... Or maybe he spoke afterward, I guess.
Right. Now, the other big thing that the family demanded, this was kind of a shock thing, the family demanded that the city pay for the funeral. Kind of macabre family having to demand. You'd think the city would automatically pay for the funeral of any family member shot in those circumstances. The family also complained in public at the city council session that nobody from the city council had come round to apologize or even comfort or offer condolences. And they said this isn't normal. In many communities, the police will send, or the city will send a chaplain around, a religious person or other comforter. And quite often a city council person or some representative of the city will also show up there. It's actually abnormal to leave a grieving family in that situation.
course, what it shows is that the city is downplaying, disregarding, and devaluing the person that was shot, and in so doing, supporting the police department that shot that person.
I think so. And
or the police officers.
And the mayor was really held somewhat to task. Mayor Ana Caballero, who's probably, in other ways, a very much admired person for being a Latina, relatively young, who's risen to that office. But she was obviously comes from the privileged, well-educated part of the Latino community and does not relate to these more Indio-type mixed-blood or basic proletarian type of people.
So Jose Hernandez, the man who was killed by police about a month ago, came from a poor family?
Yeah, he did. Here's the interesting thing. He was disturbed because of the bombing of Belgrade, the killing of civilians. That's what set him off. He's age 40 years old. He's been a military veteran himself. I don't know what action he was ever taking part in. Might have been the Gulf War at that age. But he was extremely upset about the bombing, and that set him off, and he felt suicidal. So you see, all these things are connected. It's a big web.
And that was originally the reason that the police came to the house, was because his sister was concerned that he was suicidal, not that he was homicidal or a danger to them.
Right, exactly. And finally, I'll just conclude with one other person who spoke at that meeting, and that was another war veteran who was limping. He had a wounded leg from war activities. He fought in Vietnam, actually, and he was a partly Native American guy, and he said that in July last year, the same police department, Salinas Police Department, came on a raid to his house and jumped on his daughter, who was pregnant at the time, very advanced pregnancy, made her lie on the ground, forced her to the ground, and there were complications later in the birth of that child. So he had a lot of complaints about that issue.
How many people were at the city council meeting there?
Oh, I think there were about 80 people.
And
about the same as last time they had a vigil.
And how many? That was 80 people specifically for this issue?
Yeah.
Not just to see McPherson?
No. Specifically for this.
This was a rally organized by the Hernandez family or by another group. I know Stolen Lives, a group that's concerned about police killings, has been doing a lot of organizing.
There was a spokesperson for Stolen Lives, the victims of police slayings. And there were Barrios Unidos, young guys. There was a Yaqui Indian.
Was Scott Kennedy there, perhaps, from Barrios Unidos? Were there any Santa Cruz Barrios Unidos people?
I don't think so. There was Yaqui Indian Tribal Council. And there was LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens. There was NAACP of Salinas. Those were the principals.
Perhaps some members of the Citizens Police Review Board from Santa Cruz attended?
But one old friend, John Caza, whom I telephoned myself, a Monterey resident, came over, and an ACLU member, John Caza, who suffered police abuse himself quite a bit.
Has the ACLU agreed to support the Hernandez family, or is it seeking some kind of injunction?
I'm sure we would have been told. There was
no ACLU support.
But wait a minute. I may be wrong about that. The family is preparing a suit. I heard the family is preparing a suit, and I think the ACLU is involved, together with NAACP, as far as I recall.
Because I think the ACLU may have been involved in the aftermath of the Vaughn shooting in Monterey, where the older black activist who simply does not want to be committed to a hospital was on the roof, allegedly with a corkscrew, and then was shot from the ground, or capped from the ground, by one of the police officers back in May of 1998.
Well, his son, Charles Vaughn Jr., frequently shows up at these kinds of events, together with Mel Mason.
He
wasn't there this time.
Alate, I believe.
I believe the ACLU is much more active in Monterey County on these issues.
Well, Nick Whitehead, thank you very much for that report on the, I guess, public protest against the shooting of Joe Hernandez. Is there anything planned in the near future in San Luis?
No, I don't have any information. I'll come back as soon as we have it.
And if you want to get more information, do get in touch with HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom in Santa Cruz, at 423-HUF.
And at least in Salinas, people are expressing some outrage and concern. I guess that happens when the fatal bullets get unloosed, as it did here in the Happy John Dine case back 2 years ago in November of 1997. Unfortunately, we've had no action, and perhaps we'll see no action, unless the community rises up and decides to demand that that action be taken. I suppose we can count ourselves lucky. There have been no further fatal shootings, although Brian Andrus was shot 5 times and then dumped in jail, prison, for his pains. And the officers who shot him are still on the streets carrying guns and sporting bright, spiffy uniforms with our taxpayer money. Situation which really requires some serious reflection and some real action. There's actually, I guess, a budget hearing, or I guess a series of a priorities hearing, and it's going to be taking place in the police department in a week or two. I'll be announcing the more details about that meeting. I read about it in the Citizens Police Review Board packet, and the Citizens Police Review Board, as I mentioned, meets tomorrow. It meets every month on the second Monday of the month at 5:30 at City Hall across from the library. And I think, unfortunately, they're not going to be televising this one. I think they only televise every 2 every year, something like that. But to be sure, you should give a call to the CPRB, which has open office hours from 9 to 1, Monday through Friday, generally. There's a couple of exceptions to that. Their phone number is 420-9562. And I continue to recommend people file complaints with them, not because you have any expectation of getting a fair or useful result as far as you're concerned, but rather because it essentially leaves a paper trail for defense attorneys of the future to use in pitches motions in which they can get the names of officers who've been abusive, I should say, if they're dealing with an abusive officer, they can get the names of individuals that have complained about him. If you haven't complained about him, they can't get to you, and then you can't testify in trials and so forth. Or that the evidence that you are presenting for the public gets completely lost, and that's a bad thing, even if we can't get these timid hearts to do anything on the issue because they don't want to cross a city council that's disinclined to do anything to begin with. I really was going to do some analysis of the Citizens Police Review Board's last meeting, but I kind of promised myself and those around me that I would try to, whenever I had that kind of urge and itch to talk about the board, I would talk instead about the police department, because that's really what we were concerned about, is problems in the police department, how to reform and change the police department so it really becomes representative of the community and protective of the community, and not some little organization that was set up as a kind of a fig leaf to assure everybody that all complaints are being dealt with. And I think that, you know, I've spent so many hundreds of hours on that body and that board that it really is time to turn to the police department itself. So you should be aware this show is hopefully a conduit for talking about police misconduct in a public way. And that may seem kind of scary, and in a way, of course it is, because the police officer you're talking about, and we hope you talk about him by name, and that you speak accurately about what happened to you, him or her by name, because there really isn't any real forum for people to do this in other than one that we create ourselves. And I hope that free radio, I know some other shows are, certainly mine is, a forum for looking into police misconduct. So if you have any concerns about the police department, if you have any commendations about the police department, police officer has been very helpful to you, you've found something that gives you some optimism, please do give me a call here at 427-3772, and while you're at it, call the mayor at 420-5020 and tell him to let homeless people sleep and put the issue, for God's sake, on the agenda. Well, let's have a little musical break here, and we will return. We tried to reach, by the way, well, we're going to continue to try to reach him. I'll get right back to you.
Oh, the fine-looking People agree it's no big sin to sit on our butts drinking beer while we're watching some pigskin. We Washington locals don't like Texas yokels. They're such a bizarre bunch of guys. The question we're saying while Dallas is playing is, will the defendant please rise? Oh, mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Though out on the field they may play pretty well, it's hard to throw touchdowns while locked in a cell. Their huddle formation is breaking probation, and OJ's the next one they'll sign. Hey, why's the crowd roaring? Could Dallas be scoring? Or snorting the 50-yard line? Oh, Bubba's, whether the Cowboys play Redskins or Niners, the game gets exciting when Switzer is boarding jetliners. Yes, when the game runs out, they pull the big guns out like Cowboys who once ruled the earth. They could win it this season, which could be the reason next Super Bowl's at Leavenworth.
Yeah, it's over there.
It's kind of hard to do here.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to distribute food here also. We would like that colleges would be more cooperative.
It would be nice
we
if
used
they were.
To distribute there, but it takes a while to get all the permits and everything.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And okay, it's about 6 o'clock. We're across from the Gap with Santa Cruz's True Street Poet on the street.
Howdy. This one's called Glassine Bouquet. Glassine Bouquet, wild, gathered in the tramp jungle. For you, passed in a matchbook. For you, whispered like a ribbon. I pulled together a life mask, a harvest, your lips, a glimpse of rib nudging darker skin. Have I left clues, traces, vapor trails? Doubtful. Light a match, wave it out, bouquet shatters. I sigh as you walk away. And that's it.
Thank you.
What, 10 after 6?
Yeah, well, I was just explaining that Mr. Jackson from Jackson's was upset because the Cousteau Society of Greenpeace and Sierra Club put all the positive energy and concern across the leopard rainbow chalk peace signs everywhere. They're like magnetohydrodynamic flywheels spinning in synchronicity. That's how we're going to build this whole train that goes all the way from Seattle to Disneyland so we can watch the next animatronic robot simulated in ways.
What I see here is, of course, many, many peace signs in the little kind of square concrete segments which make up the sidewalk, which, of course, it's in washable chalk, so
yeah.
I presume it can be washed out.
Yeah,
I presume it's washable.
He was upset because somebody came in the middle of the night and drew peace signs over it, and I said, well, it was only in chalk, and you know, I can't stop those kids from playing hopscotch, man. I mean, like, the kids have been doing that.
Of course, he has a right to be upset, too.
No, I understand, but what I'm saying is the reason it's being done is because there's so much peed and pompoo in Steamer's Lane. The only way to clean it up is by switching to fuel cells, flywheels, and hydraulic carburetors, magnetohydrodynamic.
Slow down. Now, tell me, Billy, what... there was no... punitive action taken against folks, right?
The largest environmental network in the world is Cousteau Society, Greenpeace, and Sierra Club, and that's where we're helping them build the soul train because it runs on magnetos and bicycle pedals.
So what's happening down here on the mall? Any harassment of local musicians? How we doing?
No. Mr. Jackson was a little upset because some people wrote peace signs all over the street.
We got that.
Chalk. But I explained to him why, and it's only a chalk, and it comes off easily.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, he can always, come out with a hose and get rid of it, and so the city no doubt will soon.
First night, everybody's allowed to draw on the street with chalk.
No, every night, everybody is allowed to draw on the street.
Yeah, it's freedom of communication.
That's correct.
That's a sovereign right in every country.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Billy.
You communicate, right?
Any comments, passers-by, on the evening?
Comments on the evening?
Yes. I mean, what have you observed in your travels, your perambulings, your
meandering?
It's
fucking cold. There's a bunch of fucking people wandering around buying trinkets. It's the mall, man.
It's a shrewd observation, certainly. Any comments from you?
Mr. Twister's getting quite elaborate with his art. That's an observation we were making.
Twisting but not twisted.
He's got just some incredible things going on, balloon-wise.
Looks like a monkey on bananas.
He's got balloon things with moving parts, man.
This could be the thing of the future.
Yeah.
And now you have some comments, sir.
Yes. My comment was is that all the isolated incidents that happened around.
And we're talking about New Year's Eve.
Yeah, New Year's Eve. Uh-huh. That happened around the entire nation. We're all drunken, like. You can't really call them yuppies, but it was like the people that the nation has considered are supposedly the good people, and of course, us street people are the cause of all the problems and all the crime.
Now, were street people targeted on New Year's Eve for removal by police, as far as you said?
I don't know. Here, we didn't have any problems. I mean, me and all the other street kids, we didn't really have any problems.
Street people were able to drink freely, just like everyone else? Is that what you're suggesting?
I don't know. I didn't drink, but I didn't see any problems with any of the street folk. Now, of course, I mean, the few problems I did see were, like, the kids who live at home with their parents but like to hang out on the street and play tough guys because they know all about living on the streets. Hell, they watch it on MTV.
Right.
But all the problems around the nation, all the isolated incidents that they had.
There just was no Y2K crisis, was there?
No.
Now, there was no attempt to overthrow the government.
All the street folk around the whole... around the whole nation.
Are you drunk on Coca-Cola? Is that what's going on here?
No, I had the hiccups. But all the street folk around the whole nation were very well behaved for New Year's Eve. There was no riots.
Well, certainly you can speak for Santa Cruz because you were out here on the streets. And you saw folks generally well behaved. What about the police? Were they well behaved in Santa Cruz?
The police, from what I saw, yeah. They did good. They didn't get their big ego. And the good thing was that the thing that I did see, they were traveling in groups of three, and the one wearing the baseball cap was the one in charge. And the ones that they had in charge of these groups were the cops who normally work this beat. You know, the cops normally work this strip here. And those guys, because they're used to working out here, they know how it is dealing with these people here, and they did a good job.
So there wasn't a clearing away of people who were drinking just because they were, should we say, street people?
I do not believe so.
For example, this scoundrel, I mean, I would have cleared him away immediately. You, sir, were you cleared away on New Year's Eve?
No, they were very nice.
And we think, was that generally the case or just in your case?
No, they were very nice.
Yes, who was very nice?
The police.
What is your experience?
In spite of their bad press that they got the day before, which I thought was abominable.
On New Year's Eve, I saw the police throwing some guy in his wheelchair into the back of a van and locking him up in a cage.
Well, perhaps he was a murderer.
Other than that, I don't know who he was.
Maybe he was going to kill someone with his wheelchair.
Could have been. He looked like a threat, sure.
So you felt this might have been... was this a wheelchair guy who looked, should we say, poor? Or a
by the way, my name is Jonathan Doe.
J.D., yes.
Yeah, J.D. for sure.
J.D., another one of his many aliases. So, J.D., any other incidences on... Where did you see this wheelchair
captured?
Well,
it's not really J.D., he's a friend of mine, but...
Where did this capture take place?
Oh, this was at the end down by Benicio's liquor store and all the bars down there.
What time?
That alcohol thing, you know. I don't know, it's like every time I went down there, they were arresting somebody down by the liquor store.
So, about what time was this arrest, do you remember?
You know, it was like, seemed like kind of early on as the evening was just sort of
you know,
going.
Did you know the man arrested?
Oh, no, I didn't
was
even see.
Was he swearing at the police, throwing bottles?
I didn't see anything before the arrest, I just saw them throwing him in.
But there might have been some justification?
Could have been, for all I know. But I know that the general public really made it a nice place out here that night.
And you saw no other instances of...
I give all the credit to such a wonderful night to the people that were here. It had nothing to do with anything the police did. It was the people that made it a nice evening.
And there you have it from our Doe on the street. And a Dodo he is, I must say. Thank you, Mr. Doe.
Thank you.
We're talking to a man who has been evicted from the shelter. Your name, sir?
My name is David Kirk. I was evicted from the shelter for 6 months for not fighting. I was standing in line for seconds on the 22nd of December. And this lady came up to me, and she goes, "I'm first." And she was, because she hadn't eaten yet. And I go, "Well, I don't care." And she goes, "Oh, yeah?" And she turned around and slapped my plate out of my hand, and it fell on the ground. I picked it up, and I went, "Oh, yeah?" And I splattered it, you know, what I had left on the plate. And I go tell your hero boyfriend to come and save your life, and he hit me midsection. And before we could even get into a fight, they kicked me off of the lot for 6 months, and they're still going
there.
This was
at the armory, or this was at the church?
Yeah, the shelter, the resource center.
I see. Claire?
And now I can't even go to the armory. And
don't worry, I won't bite you, and I'm not infectious.
That's Jennifer. Jennifer's cool.
Anyway, so...
That's a problem. Have you talked to the head of the program about it yet?
No, I'm waiting to get in the newspaper.
I'm not the man to talk to. I put it on the radio.
I wasn't thinking you were.
Right.
You were. I was just saying. Yes.
Can you shut that down for a minute?
Sure. So we just talked to Jennifer, whose boyfriend died of a heroin overdose a couple months back. She's very concerned that people who are having medical problems like with heroin and who need to call in emergencies don't get threatened with ticketing, don't get threatened with jail and warrant checks if they call in, don't get threatened with felonies when there's a medical emergency. And hopefully she'll be talking about that at the Homeless Issues Task Force on Monday, December 27th. Okay, we're talking to
Cheryl.
Cheryl, we spoke to you about a month and a half, 2 months ago. You were trying to deal with so-called panhandling tickets, which seemed to me to be given to you by an officer who was not following the municipal code, because he was giving you a ticket for holding a sign rather than for aggressively soliciting.
That's right.
And so what's happened recently around that?
Recently, about a week ago, or a couple of weeks ago, we got harassed down by our camp by a city cop. So we couldn't be staying there. And he read my name through, and he says, oh, you got an outstanding warrant.
And the warrant was for?
It was for soliciting in front of the post office.
And you found that out because he went to jail, or how did you find it? Did he have that record in the computer? Or?
I guess it was all of a sudden in computers after I checked on it.
So when did the police officer and you have this conversation?
About maybe a week ago, 2 weeks ago.
Did he take you to jail, or did he just tell you there was a warrant?
He just gave me another ticket.
Gave you another ticket?
Yeah.
But it seemed the point is that this ticket, which perhaps should have been dismissed, which you tried to show up in court for, but couldn't find, is now returning to haunt you.
That's right.
Well, I would encourage you to come to the Homeless Issues Task Force meeting on Monday. It's meeting Monday at 5:30.
Yeah. Santa Cruz local for over
we're talking to
years, and I'm trapped in Watsonville. Squirrel.
And Squirrel, last, of course, you're infamous for your involvement with the River Street refugees way back when.
Yeah, they still closed it down, though, and put a bunch of high-priced, like, rehab places there.
Community house, Page Smith Community House. And you've been living in Watsonville?
Yeah, I'm living in this one place. It's like used to be like three-something, then they raised it by five, let's see, 20... It was like $3.21, and then they raised it by $5 because they said they were doing gardening that they never did. And then it got raised just recently to...
Are you better off than you were 3 years ago or 4 years ago?
Well, I think I ate better when I lived on the street, but at least I don't have to worry about getting sick because I'm freezing my butt off. Because when I was homeless, I spent most of my money on food. Now I spend most of my money on rent.
So you're keeping the landlord well fed. That doesn't make you feel better? I mean...
Yeah, he raised our rent to $370.38 this month. The next month it's going up to $400.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah,
listen,
I can get a place down in this area. I'm on a waiting list for one place, but I'm still waiting.
Thank you, Squirrel.
Thank you.
All right, Don.
Well, you know, I'll believe you. What's your name?
My name is Robert Murley.
And Robert, what's happened?
They. Cops keep harassing me. They won't leave me alone. I'm not doing anything wrong. They already told me that. They said it's all politics, and they said all the tourists have money. I said, why aren't you? That guy's got an open container right there, and he goes, he's a tourist. He's got money.
Now, when was the last time, Robert, that you got trouble from the cops?
Boy, I tell you, pretty quick. A couple of days ago.
And where were you?
Down on the beach. I live on the beach.
And what part of the beach?
Down by the wharf.
And what happened?
He cited me for
you're pulling some yellow tickets out of your wallet, huh?
A lot of them.
How many tickets do you have in your wallet there?
Probably five.
And what are they? Are they all for the same thing or different?
All for the same.
What is the offense that they claim you're violating?
They for drinking, for open container, and they come chase me or stop here. Let's see what we got. I have to go to court on the 18th of January.
And that's how it is. If you live outside, even if you're over 21, being in possession of an open container is a basis for an infraction, and if you can't pay for the infraction, you don't get to court to deal with it. That's a warrant and a misdemeanor. A felony helps the community instead of the big corporations like the National Association of Broadcasters. And apparently some of the fall-in-line public radio stations, which are also pressing the FCC to eliminate the possibility of micropower broadcasting, which is what we are. We're a micropower station. You can hear us in Santa Cruz and in some outlying areas, but we're really very, very small in the scheme of things. We don't do commercials. We do what we think needs to be done, and we try to provide open access to the community in a way that other stations don't. If you want to help Free Radio Santa Cruz, you can give a call to the voicemail at 427-4523. Drop us a check at Post Office Box 7507, California 95061, or email us at freeradiosantacruz@cruzio.com. Now we got a call.
Hi, you're on the air with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
You have an AT&T collect call. Caller, at the tone, please say your name.
Wiley Drake.
For rate information, say operator now.
Will you accept charges? Please say yes, no,
yes,
or op. Thank you for using AT&T.
Hello.
Hello, Wiley Drake.
Hey, Robert, how you doing, brother?
I'm good, and I guess you're spinning from 3,000 miles away. We're talking.
Yes, I'm in Washington, D.C.
And Wiley, let me introduce who you are to the radio audience. You are a reverend of the, give us your church.
First Southern Baptist Church of Buena Park and the homeless center called Here's Hope.
And can you briefly kind of cap off what you've been doing for the last few years that's excited the attention of the local police and government?
Well, basically what happened is we decided as a church to move outside the four walls and invite homeless people and poor people in. We found out that the homeless people didn't have any place to sleep or to eat or to take a shower or go to the bathroom. And so we opened our church to them because we had a kitchen and we had bathrooms and we had plenty of space in our church building for them to sleep. And then we also started helping the poor people in the area who did have homes but needed groceries and food and clothing and furniture and those kind of things. And we opened that up then to about 400 families, and then the city came against us. And to make a long story short, they told us we had to shut down. If we didn't shut down, they would come after us. They did come after us. The health department, the fire authority, and everybody gave us a clean bill of health. The city then came back and said, we're going to shut you down anyway, and we will find a way. So if you don't kick these homeless people out in the street, and we had about 35 then, we will shut you down. We'll come against you with legal means. And they charged me with 11 criminal misdemeanors that carried with it an $11,000 fine total and 5 years in jail. They held that over my head and said, if you don't throw these people out in the street, we're going to bring these charges against you. To make a long story a little bit shorter, hopefully, we said no, we wouldn't kick them out, and so we went to court. By the time we got through and got to a jury, it had been narrowed down to 5 charges. We were found guilty on 4, and the 4 basically had to do with 2 things. Number one, we wouldn't kick the homeless people out in the street. And number two, we had changed the use of a building from recreation, they said, to mercantile because we were storing and distributing food. So we went to court. They did find me guilty. The judge gave me 1,500 hours of community service, a probation order for 3 years, and with the agreement that we would not sleep more than 52 people and that we indeed would proceed ahead with building a newer, bigger building to house the homeless.
So in effect, the judge said, keep letting those homeless people stay there. And I understand he also waived your community service, saying you'd already done your time by helping all those homeless people.
He basically said, we're giving you 1,500 hours of community service, but you've obviously already served more than 1,500 hours in the last years, so we'll count it as time served. Mm-hmm. And so we proceeded ahead then to apply for permits to the city. We spent over $20,000 to the city of Buena Park for permits. We got our permits. We started building our building. We built a 517-foot block wall that people donated bricks and labor and money for. We also got the property graded, which was about a $65,000 project that was donated to us. and we have the property ready to go, ready to build the foundation and start building the building. But we ran into a problem with the city. Number one, our permits, because we have moved slow because we're dependent upon donations, we did not move fast enough, and we asked the city for an extension. They refused it now and told us that we moved too slow, we didn't build fast enough, and we went back into negotiations last Wednesday night, and the bottom line of the negotiations were they agreed finally that they would reissue us a building permit to build this building, but only after we could prove to them that we either had the money in the bank or the materials on property to not only start the building, i.e. the foundation and the wood and the shingles and the doors and the windows, etc., but that we would have the wherewithal to have it all there before they would ever issue our permit. So we are stopped dead in the water now until we get some $350,000 to $400,000 in cash or materials to build the building.
Now, are you still serving people at night in the temporary
building? We serve three meals a day. We have about 400 families come to us on a monthly basis.
No, I mean,
are
the people
homeless but are poor? We sleep about 100 people in a 24-hour period. We figured out a way to sort of get around their 52 limit. They only allow us to sleep 52 at night, and we never violate that, but we do, when those people get up early in the morning around 4 or 5 o'clock to go to work, we put other people in, so we shift sleep, and in essence sleep 3 8-hour shifts in a 24-hour period.
Wiley, I know you've also gone to court to help homeless people. How's that going? Are the courts in the Buena Park area treating homeless people any better than they used to?
It goes from one extreme to the other. Sometimes I go in the courtroom and the judge is very praising. Thank you, Pastor Drake, for coming. And they try to work out community service for us. We are a community service facility for the courts of Orange County. That means if somebody gets 20 hours of community service, they can come to the First Southern Baptist Church, and we indeed can allow them to do their work with us, and we have to, of course, sign their court paper. So we are an official of the court on community service. But it goes from one extreme to the other, Bob. Some of them, the judges are very cooperative. They send them to us. Others are not very cooperative.
Now, wait a minute. You're a convicted misdemeanor, and you're an official of the court? Well, I must commend you on that.
Well, that's exactly the way. That's exactly the circumstance.
So you are continuing then to sleep homeless people. In fact, you're cramming them in, it sounds like, to the rafters in order just to... I take it there's a crisis in Buena Park. There's been an increase in homelessness in the last few years.
There's been an increase in homelessness, and in the county of Orange County, we have about 15,000 homeless people, and there are only about 700-800 beds available, not counting ours. And so you can obviously see the problem.
Well, I've heard that L.A. Food Not Bombs has recently been attacked by the Los Angeles Police Department, and indeed they were shut down for a little while, but the American Civil Liberties Union took a suit and got an injunction successfully allowing them to reopen in Pershing Park. Have you been in touch with that at all?
Only from afar, because we've had our own little thing going, and we've been praying for them and working for them. One of the things that's going on in our city that we've been fighting, and we couldn't fight with the folks, Food Not Bombs, we certainly agree with them and certainly support them. And even though we don't, I, as a very conservative right-wing, you know, obviously be strange bedfellows for us to be involved with the ACLU. However, we have before. We signed on back when there was a movement afoot to make food stamps unavailable to anyone who had a drug conviction. We said, hey, if they had a drug conviction, they're off drugs now and they've turned their life around. That shouldn't disqualify them for food stamps. And the ACLU put that forth, and we signed on with that.
Were they successful in that?
And so far, I think we've been fairly successful with that. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's going on in our town, though, and we're hoping that the ACLU, and I hope if they're listening, or I hope if you have contact with them, you'll have them get in touch with us, because, again, they're a little bit hesitant to get involved with Wiley Drake because he's sort of a radical. But we have our city, and other cities are doing it, too, a city council that is summarily passing ordinances that are anti-homeless. For example, we have 20 motels in Buena Park that are mom-and-pop motels. During the year of the summer months, when Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm are booming, those motels are full. But during the winter months like now, those motels almost starve to death because there's no business coming into the motels during this time of year. And so in order to stay in business, those motels rent to people that we are rehabilitating, that is, that have gotten back on their feet, gotten a part-time job, and they live in these motels by the week. Buena Park passed an ordinance that said you can't stay more than 30 days. The motel owners circumvented that and got around that by making people check out on the 29th day and check back in one day later. The city of Buena Park recently passed, just a week ago, and it goes into effect January the 28th, another ordinance that says you not only can't stay more than 30 days in a motel in Buena Park, but you can't stay more than 60 days in a six-month period. And so they're summarily passing ordinances that indeed will run the homeless people out of town. That's their motive. They wouldn't admit that, but that's their motive, is to get rid of the homeless people.
Sounds like it's what was done in the park system to stop people from using the state and parks for, you know, lodging purposes, even if they were clean and fastidious and didn't cause trouble. Apparently there's this just blanket prejudice, no pun intended, against homeless people. Any other anti-homeless laws? I know you yourself were so upset with the way the police were operating that you ran against the police chief at one point, right?
Yeah, and here's the other thing that's happening here as well. These 15 or 20 motels in town, because they're small businessmen, have banded together and formed what they call the Buena Park Small Business Association. And they have asked me to come on board and be their spiritual counselor and spokesperson. And we've just had a meeting, and they're going to hire an attorney to file a lawsuit against the city of Buena Park on behalf of the motel owners, because they believe that they're violating not only the homeless people, but the motel's constitutional right and their patrons, which would be any customer. And so we will be forthcoming in the very near future with the lawsuit against Buena Park.
How are the social service agencies lining up in this fight?
Well, again, they go both directions. We have social service workers that come to us, that bring people to us, send people to us. I have social case workers that come to me and say, you know, we're trying to help this family, but there's one way we can't help. They need more groceries, for example, and we don't have any other resources. Can you help them? And we do. On the other hand, we have Child Protective Services come out sometime and pick up kids that are living in a motel. The motel is perfectly clean, perfectly safe, but because the children are in the motel with their parents and there's no evidence of food in the motel, because they walk a block and a half and eat all three meals at our church. We serve three meals a day, 7 days a week. And so social services has come in and indeed said to those parents, you're neglecting your children because we don't see any evidence of food in your motel room. And they explained to them, and we've even certified the social services, that yes, they do indeed eat their meals here. You can come check our kitchen out and see that we feed very nutritious food. It's not just passed out in the park. It's we feed excellent food, three meals a day. But some social services say, no, only thing we're going to do is look at the evidence in their place of residence, which is a motel.
So would you say, if you were going to contrast the situation now with 3 or 4 years ago in Buena Park, certainly an increase in homeless people, and you think that as a consequence of this increase, and possibly, I'm suggesting, maybe anti-homeless laws passed in other jurisdictions, that's the claim sometimes of cities, that Buena Park is taking a similar response, or is Buena Park initiating this attack on the homeless?
Well, I think in this particular area, Buena Park is initiating the attack, and others are sort of following suit. We also are finding, Robert, not only the cities are doing this, but we've had an experience in Los Alamitos, which is an adjoining small community that is a very high-income community, but there's a small Roman Catholic church and a large Roman Catholic church in the town of Los Alamitos. The Orange County Diocese has decided to close the small church and incorporated into the large church.
And the significance?
Now, the difference there is that church, it's St. Isidore's Church, they have been doing the same thing we've doing, except sleeping people. They store food in the church, and they have a homeless ministry called We Care, and we've been networking with them for years, and they work in the same basic community we do in the same county. We work together, we pass out food together, clothes together from each of their churches, and geographically, if they're closer to them, we send them to them. if they're geographically closer to us, they send them to us. And the Orange Diocese said, we're closing that church. And the 200 members of the church who were low income, they're not homeless, they're just low income, said, why are you doing it? We're helping the homeless, we're helping the poor, we have our church. And they said, well, the building needs to be retrofitted for earthquake. And a Muslim gentleman came along and said, I hire people from that community, low income employees from that community, they're good people. And he just so happened to have a business that retrofitted buildings for earthquake, and he said, I'll retrofit the building absolutely free. The Orange Diocese said, well, you can't afford a Spanish-speaking priest. And so the
wait a minute, you mean they have a Spanish-speaking priest now and they can't afford
it? No, they didn't have a Spanish-speaking priest, mm-hmm. And they said, you have to have one because most of you people are Hispanic. And so the Hispanic congregation said, look, we only have one or two people that do not speak English, so we don't need a Spanish-speaking priest. And so as it turned out, they were using the retrofit and the no Spanish priest as reasons to close the church.
Did you get any scuttlebutt from inside the Catholic Church as to why this pressure came at this time? Or?
Well, there's two reasons. One is they're feeding the homeless, and they're in a very upper-class neighborhood of Los Alamitos, right down the street from the racetrack where the big gambling's going on, and right up the street from $300,000-$400,000 homes. And those people don't like homeless people in this little Catholic church either, mm-hmm. because the big church has a fence around it, and no one can get to it. But this little church is right in the community, right on the street, on a main street, and so that's where the poor and the homeless people go, as well as where Roman Catholics who like a small church rather than a big church go. And I've appealed to Cardinal Mahoney in Los Angeles. They're building a billion-dollar edifice in Los Angeles.
Well, this is all for the glory of God.
Yeah. And the point of it is, what the parishioners are saying is that there's two reasons why the diocese is closing this church. Number one, if they close it, that will close the homeless ministry. Number two, if they close it, they can sell the property for a high dollar amount, and that high dollars can go into the edifice in downtown Los Angeles and Cardinal Mahoney's legacy.
Well, if I take it this ministry has been going on for some years.
It's been going on for years, about 7-8 years that I know of. Basically, here's what happened. There was an organization formed, a nonprofit organization, called We Care, and it had no tie to any church. It was totally nonprofit, totally non-religious, just a group of people who said, we want to help the poor and homeless in Los Alamitos and in our corner of the county. And when they did that, they said, well, we're small, we don't have much money, we need a building to meet in and a building to store our food in. And they said, we can't afford rent. And so St. Isidore said, we have an educational building. We don't use it for that. We have a church, but we have an educational building. So we'll let you use. And so they let them use the building rent-free and even pay the electricity for them. And so We Care has been able to function as a ministry to homeless and poor because they don't have to pay any rent or pay any electricity. That's a big part of your cost.
But, in fact, isn't the reason, there must be some reason why they didn't move on the folks in the last 7 years. Has there been suddenly an upsurge in property values, or has there been some, you know, political shift in the Catholic Church? Do you have any sense of why at this particular time?
My guess is that it's Diocese of Los Angeles, even though the Roman Catholic hierarchy is such that each diocese is autonomous, and my feeling is that Mahoney is building this million-dollar or billion-dollar edifice in Los Angeles, and he needs money, and he could probably get $2, maybe $3 million out of this little piece of property and only affect, a couple hundred people, so they can just sort of, they just want them to blend into the other church.
So it's
as well as there's an increase in emphasis on feeding the poor and the homeless in that little church, and I'm sure some of the people in the community are saying, we don't want our property values to go down, and you know, we don't want these homeless people here, so we want these people out of town.
Now, the Los Angeles Coalition Against Homelessness and Hunger has also been taking strong stands on laws against the homeless, destruction of services, criminalization of people who feed or lodge the poor. Have you been in touch with them at all?
Again, only briefly, because there's only so many hours in a day, kind of thing, and I'm not giving an excuse, but I just haven't been able to get with them. I am back here in D.C. now, trying to get to talk to homeless coalition here in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Was not able to hook up with them because I was only here for a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
I was also given the name of what's referred to as the apostolic nuncio, which is equivalent to the ambassador from the Vatican to the United States in matters of church and state. And I have communicated with him, and he agreed to meet with me, but he was not able to meet with me this trip. And so he has agreed to meet with me, and I have sent to him a thank you for agreeing to meet with me, as well as if he does not reopen this little church, and the church has been closed since September the 1st, if the local bishops and the U.S. Apostolic Nuncio does not agree to reopen this little church, then I have asked for them to give me the proper protocol to indeed go to the Vatican for an audience with Pope John Paul.
Wow. Well, I don't know what to say. It's you're traveling in these rarefied circles there, Wiley.
Well, you know, you just have to do what you have to do, because homeless people are hungry, and poor people are going hungry and struggling, and we just have to do everything we can to fight and fight for them, because they don't have anybody to fight for them. Their fight is to try to stay alive, not starve to death, or not get kicked out of their apartment because they have to spend part of their rent on food. And so nobody can fight for them, and so we're doing our best to.
Well, does this put you on the other side with the Giuliani, Hillary Clinton dispute on the homeless in New York City?
Well, I've talked to some people up in New York, and I'm not sure which side it puts me on. Somebody called me up and said, "You're buddies with Hillary now," and I said, "Well, I'm not sure I like that, but."
You don't have to be on one side or the other. I think one can oppose Giuliani's policies without signing on to Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think that's right. My feeling is this. My understanding is this, is that there are, initially people were saying, well, they're making people work, and if they don't work, they're not going to feed them. They're just going to throw them in jail. And I think that was an oversimplification. We have a if you don't work, don't eat policy at our church, but it's not a matter of having a job. If they can find a job and go out and get a paying job, that qualifies them to eat with us. If they can't qualify for a job or can't find a job, then we have them work for us. So we do have a rule that says if you don't work, you don't eat.
Well, Giuliani's policies in New York City are pretty notorious. I don't think they bear much resemblance to your policies in Buena Park.
No, I think you're right. But yeah. At the same time, that's why I would say I would not wholesale say that I'm against a policy that forces people to work, kind of thing, you know.
Well,
I would certainly think it would have to be dealt with.
Sure, he was criticized for not letting people sleep. He was saying, you know, not only won't you be sheltered if you don't work, but you'll be arrested if you go to sleep, which is what we do in Santa Cruz. He's kind of taking a leaf from Mayor Sugar's book here in Santa Cruz. Which,
well, that's certainly what they're all doing.
Well, let me just sort of to give the audience a sense of who you are. You're not one of these liberal Democrats. You're quite on the other side of things. You oppose what we call the right to choose, or you call it pro-life.
Right.
You're a person who has spoken out against. Let me see if I get this right. Benefits for domestic partners of gays.
Well, let me just say this. I'm the author of the resolution to boycott Walt Disney Company. One of the reasons that we boycott Disney, and by the way, it's been very successful. One of the reasons we boycott Disney is over the issue of medical benefits for gay employees. That was one of 12, but the overall thing with Disney is that we were upset with them because they had taken an anti-family, anti-Christian perspective, and so we boycott them.
The point I'm making is that you are your point of view, I have strong disagreements with. I would dismiss such things as bigotry in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of your willingness to stand up for the rights of poor people, I have only the greatest respect for you. So you sometimes find interesting allies in different places.
Well, exactly. In fact, I'm at a meeting called the American Leadership Conference in Washington, D.C., and it's a meeting dealing with freedom, faith, and family. And we came together here today, legislators, governors, judges, Baptist preachers, Muslim bishops, Latter-day Saints, Roman Catholics, a whole conglomerate of about 300 religious and secular leaders coming together here to meet in the nation's capital to see what we can do to change laws that are hurting people. We talked about the homeless situation here this week. We also talked about the fact that there's an overwhelming number of people in jail that are being put there because of their color or because of the neighborhood they live in. And if even if they did break the law, they're getting extreme penalties for the law, whereas if they were of a different color in a different neighborhood, they might get 60 days, but they get 6 years.
You know, what we'd like you to do, if you're up for it, I think you did this before, is contact Santa Cruz and tell our mayor that you think his laws against sleeping are bad laws, and, you know, that it, in a sense, is a shameful thing that the city does this. Maybe we can get you to do that at some point.
I'd be glad to do that. If you would fax to me his name and the fax number and phone number, I'll be glad to let him know what we're going to do and the lawsuit we're going to bring against the city of Buena Park, and suggest to him that we might send our same lawyer up there.
Hey, we could use some lawyers. Anything you want to conclude with, Wiley?
Well, just simply to say is that, you know, there, as you said, you and I come from different walks of life in reference to many ideologies, but one of the things that you and I can agree upon is that homeless people and poor people need to be helped, and we need to have some good programs, and churches and other organizations need to be left alone. So I think we can agree to disagree on many things, but we can agree to agree in helping people. And I'm firmly convinced that in the years ahead, when we look back at the year 2000, I'm firmly convinced that the new civil rights movement, that is homeless and poor, has begun. And we are literally in the same throes of civil rights violation as Dr. Martin Luther King dealt with back in the 50s. And the year 2000, I think, we'll be able to look back and say that's really when we inaugurated the new civil rights movement. And I'm just privileged. I certainly don't compare myself to Dr. King, but I'm just certainly privileged to have a part of it.
Well, I sure hope so, and I hope that you can get this this group in Washington to denounce Santa Cruz's sleeping ban. That would be a feather in our cap if we could have that nationally done, and maybe exert a little pressure on the city council to get off its butt and do something.
We'll do our best, and there's another meeting coming up at the end of January, and if I don't get it done at this one, I'll try at that one.
Hey, thank you, Wiley Drake of Buena Park, California.
Thank you.
All righty.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yes, and that was the the interview of the day with Wiley Drake. Usually we don't catch him at such a long distance. That's the first collect call I've ever taken on this from the studio line. Usually we don't take them except from jail. I made an exception in this case. I thought it was not going to be collect, but apparently that was an error. I'm going to pay for that one. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. We cover the streets. We cover the beats. We cover the mostly outside situation and how folks are treated who are poor. And, for example, in Los Angeles, you may remember, and I think you heard me mention to Reverend Wiley Drake, the LAPD was closing in on Food Not Bombs. In response, on Tuesday, January 4th, the ACLU of Southern California, take note, ACLU of Santa Cruz, time to get off your duff, the ACLU of Southern California will announce the filing of a legal action to prevent the city of Los Angeles, including officers from the LAPD and Recreation and Parks Department, from interfering with the activities of Food Not Bombs, a group of dedicated to raising public awareness of homelessness, hunger, and poverty in L.A. by providing food to some of the city's most needy residents. In December 1999, L.A. authorities arrested 8 people for exercising their basic rights to expression and association in downtown's Pershing Square Park. On December 26th, 6 volunteers from Food Not Bombs were arrested as they attempted to provide free food to the homeless in Pershing Square. The 6 were arrested after they refused to move from the area where they have served food for the past 2 years to a less visible part of the park. None of the volunteers were blocking access to any park facility. In addition to the 6 volunteers arrested that evening, another individual who was not feeding people and is not a member of Food Not Bombs was arrested simply for videotaping the actions of officers of the LAPD and park rangers in Pershing Square. Those 7 arrests followed the arrest of another Food Not Bombs volunteer the previous Sunday, December 19th, also for feeding homeless people and for speaking out on their behalf. As a result of these 8 arrests, Food Not Bombs and its members have already been forced to curtail their speech and feeding activities in Pershing Square. The holiday season is traditionally a time for giving to those who are homeless and needy, said ALU attorney Daniel Tokaji. Unfortunately, this year, the city of Los Angeles has instead taken something vital away from its neediest residents, not only the food they depend upon, but also their voice. Our request for a temporary restraining order is an attempt to ensure that Food Not Bombs can continue to feed homeless people and speak out against poverty and hunger without fear of being arrested. And the good news is, story from January 7th. The American Civil Liberties Union won a temporary restraining order Thursday on behalf of seven activists who say the city violated their First Amendment rights when they were arrested feeding the homeless in Pershing Square. After a lengthy discussion with attorneys and activists in his chambers, U.S. District Judge J. Spencer Letts issued the order allowing members of the L.A. chapter of Food Not Bombs to continue their twice-weekly food distribution in Pershing Square without fear of being arrested. The activists had sought an order to protect them through January 17th, but the judge granted the order through Sunday. He asked the city and activists to reach an acceptable solution by Wednesday, attorneys said. He has asked us to sit down and talk, said ACLU staff attorney Daniel Tokaji. The order comes 11 days after members from the national group, which feeds and brings attention to the plight of the homeless, were arrested when they refused to stop handing out meals near a temporary ice skating rink in the park. Police said they were infringing on the operations of the rink, which has a permit. The group will resume feeding meals to the homeless on, I guess it will be Saturday. That will be yesterday. So LA Food Not Bombs, for the moment, is feeding legally. And again, San Francisco Food Not Bombs is also feeding people. If you want to get the update on San Francisco, you can check out the new Street Spirit newspaper. Picked it up from San Francisco a couple days ago, and it should be on the street shortly with homeless vendors hawking it. Give them a buck, you'll get a Street Spirit. If you're homeless and want to do some hawking of street papers, they're free to you. You can sell them for a dollar. Phone number to to get that information is 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, an organization concerned with the civil rights of homeless people and keeping people abreast of what's going on in some sectors of the homeless community and local government around homeless issues. This is 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're tuned to on your radio dial, and I'm Bathrobe's peer Robert Norse, twice weekly host to Bathrobe's Peer's Broadsides, which is a show that talks about homeless rights and other things as well. We had hoped to get in touch with Fred Geiger. We're always offering him or promising him a spot on the show, and then we always load up the show with other things, and that doesn't happen. We haven't been able to reach him. I think he's wisely decided not to wait for us. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to talk to Phil Baer. Actually, it's not instead. We're in addition. We had also planned to talk to Phil. Phil is, first we're going to hear a speech of his on the issue of the Dolphin Lee, which you may know is a couple of apartment buildings in the beach flats, which the city council, led by Catherine Byers, is determined to raise, that is to say, level to the ground, and then remodel and build as, quote, affordable housing, even though that would evict hundreds of residents who are currently in them and provide them with completely inadequate funding and no place to live, and in essence gentrify the area they're in under the guise of affordable housing. They're not considering any other options, which is another point regarding the closed process involved in this whole thing. We've invited Councilmember Tim Fitzmaurice to call in, and we know he occasionally listens to the show, at least that's the rumor, but so far, Tim has just not responded to our call, and of course, that's not strange because no one on the City Council has really given an adequate account as to what the City Council is doing, why they are ignoring other alternatives, except perhaps to say that Catherine Byers rules supreme, and whatever Kathy wants, Kathy gets. Anyway, here's a little bit of Phil, and then we'll hope to catch him live on the phone and talk some more about this. You can call in to 427-3772, that's our call-in line, and join the discussion.
Phil Baer, Beach Flats Neighborhood Association. Since we're taking this next step, I would like to remind us again of a few of the issues expressed in legal opinion written by Attorney Jonathan Whitwer, for the Women's League for Peace and Freedom, written a year or so ago regarding a previous Mercy project over close to this one. All of the issues that Mr. Whitwer raises in this letter seem germane to this project, and perhaps more germane to this project because of the significant number of people to be displaced. He raises a number of questions, and I'll only hit upon one or two of them. But he says, for example, that the only way to assure that the BSOL plan, that being the plan on the table at the time, you could substitute for that phrase, I believe, the Dolphin Lee Project, the only way to assure that the Dolphin Lee Project does not result in the immediate or eventual displacement of low and very low income families and individuals is to make project approval contingent upon replacement housing that is affordable to their income range. And I am of the opinion that that their income range on average would be something like 20% of area median income. And all of the numbers that we've heard given before were talking as if maybe we could get down so that we could make eligible people at the 55 to 60% of area median income. So there is, at the present time at least, a huge disparity between what has been discussed and getting a project that is anywhere close to something for which these actual people would be eligible. Another point that he raises, and this is his characterization of the process that has occurred to date. For the city to adopt a redevelopment plan stating that it would not displace low-income people, amend the plan to provide eminent domain authority, making no mention of impacts on low-income residents, and then introduce a project that would displace substantial numbers of low and very low-income residents without creating a PAC, a project area committee, is clearly contrary to both the letter and spirit of redevelopment law. It appears that the redevelopment plan now requires amendment to allow the displacement of low-income persons. That is because, as quoted above, the existing redevelopment plan is based on little, if any, displacement. By refusing to amend the redevelopment plan for this purpose now and to establish a PAC now that it's clear that redevelopment of the BSOL area, i.e. the Dolphin Lee Project, will displace substantial numbers of low-income persons, it appears that the city would be unlawfully circumventing redevelopment law and PAC requirements by adopting various elements of the redevelopment scheme piecemeal. And there's a lot more to this. And I think everybody who's read it now is of the opinion that this is a rather authoritative analysis of the situation. I hope this will be borne in mind and some of these questions will be answered. As I understand it, at your 1 o'clock meeting, you basically authorize Steel Cirillo to enter into negotiations about these properties. By the definition of when, according to redevelopment law, a project area committee must be formed, it is when you identify a project likely to displace substantial numbers of low and moderate income people. So if that hadn't already been done, it was certainly done by virtue of what you did at 1 o'clock today, and it's time to consider very seriously the necessity of immediately establishing a project area committee or being in violation of redevelopment law and PAC requirements.
We made no decision at 1 o'clock, and authorized absolutely nothing. I'm not sure who reported.
Tim Fitzmaurice speaking.
You, but you can tell that it's the other thing is that it is not a question of 60% or 55% or 60% of median income, but maybe we have a lack of clarity on the percentages or something. It would be quite a bit less. But would you give us a copy of whatever of the letter that you were reading? I'd like to get a copy of it.
I'll make you one.
Thank you.
That one.
Thank you.
Next. Yes, I'm Ed Davidson. I want to let me. There are two issues that I'm concerned about here. And let me start with the one that Phil just was trying to articulate. There is a provision in general plan law, chapter 10.6, that has to do with low and moderate income housing in the coastal zone. Separate provision.
Well, we have on the line with us now, just in time, Phil Beer.
Just in time to save you from Ed Davidson?
Well, now, I didn't say that. I
didn't either. That was somebody else.
I think Ed is one of the perennial hound dogs who, like myself and like you, Phil, try to bring the council back to its senses, often...
Right, good man.
...without, you know, success. Although always without success.
Ed sometimes is a little dense for me to follow, as are you sometimes, Phil, because you cover often very arcane issues. But in this particular speech, I've criticized you in the past for being,
let's not rehash that.
Schmoozy woozy with the council, but you're kicking ass with this speech, man. It doesn't sound like you're pulling any punches. But then Tim Fitzmaurice stands up, and well, let me put it this way: if you were to kind of summarize this speech for the fifth graders, of which I count myself one, how would you summarize what is the council doing, and what are you concerned about, in kind of a few words?
Well, they've got a project that they want to build down in the beach flats, which would require some 200 approximately people to leave their homes in order to demolish those homes to create the site for the proposed project. The provisions for those people are absolutely inadequate in terms of enabling them to replicate their present life circumstances. They'll never find a place in this city, probably not in this county, for the rent that they are now paying. And this very pleasant little low-income Latino community would be scattered to the four winds, and it seems cruel and quite unprogressive to me.
Well, now, you're a landlord in the beach flats, Phil. Do you have an economic interest in keeping these folks in their penury and slavery in the Dolphin Lee complex?
I haven't seen any cash yet. Actually, I think if one were talking purely in terms of capitalist motives, it would be thought that this is probably self-defeating from my landlord perspective to object to Big Brother helping the poor folk like this. But
why would it be self-defeating?
Well, most people, or one could posit the position that such a project might conceivably be good for the neighborhood and good for property values, which somehow might and would in fact gentrify the neighborhood, which might enable me to gentrify my few rentals and charge some more money for them.
You could make a pretty piece of change off this, Phil. What's your problem? You some sort of Luddite or what?
I don't know quite what it is. I've known most of the people who would be displaced for some time. It's a old, stable little community of people in these two properties, and my children more or less grew up with some of them, and I'm on very cordial terms with many of them, and I know that this is a rather charming, law-abiding, hard-working community that is doing the very best they can, and I see no reason why they should just be, not only as individuals, but the community itself would even under optimal relocation benefits, would be scattered all over the place, and the community from which they all derive a certain amount of comfort, it's like one big extended family, really, they would be scattered all over the place, and that seems unfortunate.
Well, Councilmember Fitzmaurice had a number of comments. He claimed that, first of all, you were wrong. They hadn't acted at that last council meeting, which I guess was December 14th.
Well, apparently they didn't at 1 o'clock, but right after I spoke, they did.
Right. That's what they made. They used the same confusing comment.
The reason why I didn't know what they had done at the 1 o'clock meeting was because that was a closed session meeting to which I was not privy. So if I'm misinformed, it's because they insist on having so many of these closed session meetings, and we in the public are left only to try to piece together via rumor what has actually transpired.
Right, it was the litigation session. Actually, it was the noon closed session. I actually got there because someone informed me 5 minutes before it started, and we rushed a bunch of people over, and we played our discussion on that issue. We recorded it, and we spoke to them, and they had initially a small open period before the closed litigation session, but they didn't seem too interested in anything we had to say, which essentially recapitulated the specifics of, you know, what you said.
And then they chased you out of the room and proceeded to make their decisions behind closed doors.
Right, and then they misinformed not just you, but they interrupted Roxana Kistapache at the evening session when she attempted to castigate the council for its actions by claiming that they had done nothing at the litigation session, but in fact, they authorized doing what they did later in the day, and they authorized $54,000 for Mercy Housing, which is going to be the sole service, what is it, sole source builder,
yes,
and operator of this,
yes,
this new Dolphin Lee project. Well, you know, little old liberal lady Catherine Byers seems to be the one who is pushing this program, and she rammed it through the city council about 2 months ago as a sort of, and we knew there was going to be a project in the Beach Flats, and you know, you were very concerned, as were others, that Dolphin Lee was going to be the kind of the stealth project, which is going to slip past SCAN with Andy Schifrin and Don Lane leading it, although Don disputes he was involved in that. And then I guess SCAN came out with this kind of modified statement, SCAN being the Santa Cruz Action Network, the political machine behind the city council's election victories in almost every case, every council member. They said, oh no, we're just looking for some low-income project in the Beach Flats. We aren't specifying